Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. One of my favorite lines from a movie comes from 2003's The Matrix Reloaded. It happens when Harry Lennox's character, Commander Locke, is talking to Lawrence Fishburne's character. Locke says, "Damn it, Morpheus, not everyone believes what you believe." To which Morpheus calmly replies, "My beliefs do not require them to." Such a great line. And now I've got a question for you about your beliefs. Do you believe in aliens? Regardless of how you answer that question, there are countless people around the world who not only believe in beings from other worlds, but they believe they've seen them. They've been visited by them. They've interacted with them. And in 1989, one of those accounts was portrayed by Christopher Walken as he plays the man who wrote the book behind the film and the screenplay for the film itself, Whitley Strieber. But I couldn't do this alone. So today, I'm going to be joined by a friend of the podcast. Rob Christofferson is the host of one of my favorite podcasts on the subject called Our Strange Skies and is widely regarded in the industry as an expert on all things pertaining to UFOs. I'm Dan Lefebvre, and this is Based on a True Story. Before we dive into the interview with Rob, let's set up our game. Two truths and a lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say three things, and two of them are true, which means one of them is a lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one, Whitley Strieber never referred to the beings he saw as aliens. Number two, Whitley Strieber got video footage of the beings he saw. Number three, Whitley wasn't the only one to experience some strange things. Got him? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, you'll find the two facts scattered somewhere throughout the episode, and by a simple process of elimination, you'll know which one is a lie. And if you want the answers, hang out until the end of the episode, and we'll do a recap to see how well you did. Oh, and if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Rob's show called Our Strange Skies, found wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, without further ado, let's get Rob on the line to chat about the true story behind 1989's Communion. All right, here's how this will work. We'll do this in two sections. First, let's go through the movie, and I'll do a quick overview of kind of how the movie sets up the story. Then, you'll let us know how much of that could have actually happened, at least according to Whitley's accounts. Now, there's some rather out there claims in this movie, so that'll give us a good idea of how much the movie changed and how much it sticks to the original accounts from Whitley Strieber. And then after that, after we go through the movie, we'll have an overview discussion where we'll get to talk about how much of Whitley's accounts are plausible based on your expertise. Sound good?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's do this. So initially, let's set up the timeline, location, characters. The movie starts in 1985. It starts by setting up Christopher Walken's character, Whitley Strieber. He's an author in New York City who has some kind of strange dreams. Now, before we get too far into our story today, let's just kind of set up the scene and characters there by stopping there. So I'll admit, before Communion, I'd never heard of Whitley Strieber. I didn't know anything about him. So I know a lot of times movies change names, kind of build composite characters, or just make up completely fictional ones. So, first question, is Whitley Strieber even a real person? Was he married to someone named Anne, son Andrew, kind of the family dynamic we have going on there? And, for lack of a better way to put it, was he a perfectly normal author before the events that we see in the movie in New York in 1985?
Yes, Whitley Strieber is who he is in the movie. He is a writer. By the time that Communion comes out, the film, and even the book, he had been writing for over almost 10 years. Wow. And he had written two really successful horror novels, one called The Wolfen, the other called The Hunger, and they were both actually made into films. So on that end, that is 100% true. And he did have a wife named Anne. She passed away in 2015. Mm. And their son is indeed named Andrew. In terms of a normal, you know, a perfectly normal guy, it seems like he's normal. I think that's the best way to put it, because when you read Communion, Whitley kind of says odd things at times that his wife kind of calls him out for, whether it's when we get into the experiences that he has. He talks about seeing a crystal above the house, or the time that he was flying, and like just really weird, out of place kind of, you know, statements that he makes. But for the most part, yeah, he is a pretty normal guy until the events of Communion.
Okay, well, I mean, we can kind of give that a little bit of a break. I mean, authors very often are strange, a little bit out there, maybe. I mean, you got to have the idea in your head, right? I often wonder what Stephen King is actually like to come up with some of those stories, but they're great stories. So, all right, so let's jump right into the first experience then. The movie doesn't really tell us any sort of a date, but we find out later on that this is October 4th, 1985. Whitley and his family are in their cabin in upstate New York. They got a couple of friends with them. And the first night that they're there, as everyone is in bed, the security system does something kind of weird. The lights turn on outside. First, it kind of seems like there's nothing. Then the security lights turn off. Then all of a sudden, there's this blinding light. You can tell they're not the security lights. It's something else. Everyone in the house, except for Anne, seems to see the lights. And even Whitley sees a little sliver of an alien face in his room, but he doesn't believe it's real. And the next morning over breakfast, Whitley tries to convince everyone it was just a nightmare that they all happened to have at the same time. So my question for you then is, after this first experience, was it true that that kind of what happened there in the movie, that was that the first experience? But then it seems like Whitley didn't believe it, or nobody really wanted to believe that he saw an alien, which we clearly saw in the movie there. So was that true that he didn't really even believe it himself first?
The thing about the October experience is that it was so kind of downplayed to him. It wasn't a full-blown memory of seeing this being in the corner like they set it up in the film at first. What happens to him is he wakes up to this light that passes by his living room window, and that's kind of a familiar theme over and over again in abduction accounts. Is there's usually a triggering event either involving a light or it involves a sound. So Whitley sees this light coming by the window, and all of a sudden he has the distinct impression that the roof is on fire. So he goes to check it out. And, you know, he finds that the roof isn't on fire, gets back in bed, and in the book, the next morning, he just wakes up, and that's it. When he goes into the hypnosis sessions later on, you find out that what had happened was is that there was this light that passed by outside. He did go to check on it. When he came back to bed, all of a sudden he sees this being in the corner. And in the movie, it's not the same being that he interacts with in real life. It's actually one of the shorter blue beings. And what it does is it rushes up to him. Like, and one of the freakiest things, and one of the things that this movie does terribly, is it downplays, like, how terrifying the actual quote-unquote beings are, because they move incredibly fast. They have weird, jerky movements at times, too, but it essentially has this silver rod in its hand. Whitley describes it as being more like a nail, and essentially it touches the flat end of what he thinks the nail is to his forehead, and he gets these visions, and he sees these apocalyptic visions of the world basically exploding, and he also sees this vision of it's his son sitting in a park, and he takes this as to symbolically mean that it's death, and he's screaming the entire time, and meanwhile next to him is, you later find out she's aware of it, but she essentially, in this story, is kind of like, she's there to support Whitley. That's the role that she's been assigned, so realistically, she's just laying there and acting like nothing's going on, but he's having this terrible experience. Jacques and Annie, who are the guests for the weekend, hear... I believe Jacques is actually woken up by the light. In the film, it's both of them that are woken up by the light. But Annie ends up hearing the scampering of feet upstairs. And that's just, oh, God, that's terrifying. But
not what you want to hear at night.
No, definitely not. The alien being does that for a little while. And then... It runs away, and Whitley wakes up the next morning, and they talk about the light, but it isn't as dramatic as they make it out to be in the film. It's not like Jacques is like, oh, you need to bring us home now.
Yeah, he just, like, turned on it really quick.
Yeah.
Did they have any sort of experience like that? The movie focuses on Whitley's, and then, of course, as you say, they wanted to leave right away. Did they notice anything, the guests?
Other than Jacques was just, he was woken by the light. Like, he saw the light.
But not the alien coming in.
No, or the didn't blue see being, the whatever alien. It is. Yeah, okay. And the weird thing was, that Annie didn't, I don't believe she recalled seeing the light. She just heard the scampering of feet, but never saw any of the beings.
Okay.
So, yeah, that's pretty much their experience, but it's interesting because it's, if you take that to, and coming from Whitley to be truth, well, Whitley's not the only one experiencing something.
Right. And I guess I shouldn't have called them aliens at this point, but that initial scene of seeing that is just like the stereotypical alien there, but it sounds like that's not what they saw at all this first time.
Whitley never refers to them as aliens, and part of it's just because he's trying to figure out the entire time what is going on, what's happening to him, what are these things that he's interacting with, and instead he calls them visitors. So, and he's basically, he's doing that to try to cut his bias as best as he can, and like, he does the best job possible trying to come at his experiences from as an objective viewpoint as possible.
As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn.
Okay, well, let's move on to the second experience in the movie then. That happens a couple months later, day after Christmas, actually, December 26, 1985. And this one is a little bit stranger than what the first experience was in the movie. Again, we're at the cabin in upstate New York, and we see the same bright light based on what happened the first time. We kind of have a foreshadowing of what's going to happen. But this time, the door to Whitley's room creaks open, and this is when we see the blue beings for the first time in the movie. There's four or five of them that we can see on screen at any one time, and they pick up Whitley and just kind of carry him away. And then we see a scene of what looks like the beings experimenting on Whitley. And again, the next morning, Whitley doesn't really seem to have a recollection of it, or he's just ignoring it, one or the other. He greets Anne in the kitchen and asks if she saw an owl coming through the window last night. And like, oh, this thought I saw an owl coming through. So I'm not really sure how else to phrase this, but did that happen? Was he abducted by blue creatures and then experimented on them?
So in the book, he talks about how he did see the door creak close, but the strangest thing, like when he goes through the hypnosis session in the movie, he sees this, it almost looks like a metallic dummy with a hat and a symbol on the front of it.
Yeah,
and
it rushes him, like you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and basically what he sees is an alien wearing that outfit, and it rushes towards him. And then he just...
That's the scariest part in the movie for me, when it rushes him.
Yeah, and he just blacks out. Wow. And that's a familiar thing that you find over and over again, is that these beings showing up, or just seeing them, like, your body has a tendency to react. So sometimes people will just go into complete fear mode, but 9 times out of 10 what they do is they just black out. So we don't really know if there were blue beings that actually took Whitley out, but they did take Whitley out of his bedroom. They brought him to the front porch, and then they ended up transporting him into the woods, where he was taken up into a craft of some kind. And the thing that this movie downplays a lot is that there is one being that Whitley kind of has a relationship with his entire life, and she is a female. And essentially she looks like... in the movie, there's only two kinds of beings. You got the blue ones, and then you got the really tall ones with the... they're like almost like a brownish color, and they have like the typical gray face. Well, that's essentially what she looked like. Like the model that they took from the cover of the book. If you look at the cover of the book that they released in 87, that's the exact picture of what she looked like. And then they just, like, condensed it into, well, there's only two kinds of beings, when in reality, Whitley was interacting with three of them. There was the blue ones, there was the ones that you would think of as the typical grays, only they didn't have, like, the almond-shaped eyes. They had round eyes that were black, and their mouth was, like, a round hole that was also black. And then the being that you see in the movie... This female being just interacts with over and over again, and like she's explaining what they're going to do to him, that they have these procedures that they're going to do. But the thing is like Whitley notes that she's almost sounds like she's bored, like she's done this 1,000 times. So Whitley's freaking out because what happens to him is he has this procedure done on his brain. I believe that thing in the movie where it's behind, it's on his neck, near his ear. It's this like mark he has, this puncture mark that happens. That's one of the marks that they leave on him, and then they do something with his brain, and they also do. There's a few other tests. At one point, because Whitley is just freaking out the entire time, the being asks him, "What can we do to help you stop screaming?" And he looks at her and says, "Well, you could let me smell you." Which is like, to make a story weird.
Not the first thing I probably would have. I guess I've never been in that situation, so I don't know.
It's just to make a story weirder, you know. But it kind of grounds him. So he's not freaking out, and they do a bunch more medical tests on him, and then they just send him back. But what you find is that the reason that Whitley starts remembering this thing, like all these experiences, because they go back his entire life, which the movie doesn't really get into, but because he asked that being to smell that being, That's really what triggers all of this, because Whitley doesn't need a lot of the hypnosis session isn't really for this event. It's for the October event, and he can recall most of this, which is pretty remarkable. But the reason being because he asked the being to ask to smell the being, which is.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and then it sends him down this spiral of stuff that he remembers, and and then it turns into a best-selling book.
Well, I mean, I've heard that the mind associates things with smell, so I wonder if you smell somebody's perfume, or you smell cologne, or you smell something that somebody used to have, and that kind of reminds you of them, and the mind can trigger that kind of stuff. I wonder if that's the connection that was kind of going on there.
Yeah, that's something that he does touch on in the book. He thought it was strange at first that he would say that, but he's running through it in his head. He's like, yeah, if that's something that you want, if you want to be grounded, smell is one of the easiest ways and probably one of the most strongest ways to do that. So, and the interesting thing is that the beings, smell, there's this combination of smells that is smoldering cardboard, organic sourness, and cinnamon.
That's an interesting combination.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's like, how would you make that out? I don't understand how you would make that out, because like it's not like these are three smells that go together, unless you're like really like maybe dumpster diving or something. I'm not sure, but
apparently they do go together, though. If that's what, I don't know.
And that's the thing, it's common. People report over and over again that they smell cinnamon and they smell burning cardboard.
Now, is that common after communion, or is that common before? Like, did Whitley kind of come up with that, and then other people are kind of latching onto that, do you think? Or I don't want to get too far outside the movie timeline itself, but that just curious about that.
You started to see it more and more after, and the reason that is that throughout the 80s, that's when abductions kind of blew up in popular culture, and a lot of that had to do with a book that was released in 1981 called Missing Time by Bud Hopkins. And Bud Hopkins isn't in the movie, but Whitley works with him to try and figure out what happened to him. But Missing Time kind of lays out like the features of the abduction phenomenon. And he also publishes another book in, I believe, 1983 called Intruders, about this one woman's lifelong experiences with beings kind of like Whitley. But what separates Whitley from everybody else is that he's a writer, and he's already a writer, and he has this great ability to not only tell you how he's feeling, but to make you feel what he's feeling in the book. And that for a lot of people, it has this effect where you either agree with him or you just flat out disbelieve him. And who could blame anybody? It's a tough thing to really wrap your head around. I know people, like, Communion is one of the most hotly debated books in all of UFO research, and it has been for, you know, decades now. And it's still a really good read if you want to freak yourself out a little bit and you want to really experience what a guy went through.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, we can hop back into kind of the movie's timeline. You mentioned it briefly before, the hypnosis, and this is kind of what happens next in the movie. It was actually Anne who suggests that he goes to a therapist named Dr. Janet Duffy. Now, Dr. Duffy then suggests that Whitley goes through hypnosis to help remember the things that he can't remember on his own. At first, he's kind of resistant to it, but then Anne insists and he agrees. Now, there's two separate hypnosis sessions in the movie, one for each of Whitley's experiences, although based on what you just mentioned, it sounds like he was able to remember the one in December.
Mm-hmm.
But through these sessions, Whitley kind of experiences, he starts to realize that the experiences were a little stranger than he thought at first. So the little blue doctors is what he calls them, and that's kind of what his son calls them as well. But then he also starts to remember, you know, the aliens that would be a little more traditional to what we might think of when we think of the grays, except being a little more skin tone colored, kind of like the one we saw early on. But probably the two biggest revelations to Whitney in these hypnosis sessions is that not only they're real, but he's been having them his whole life. And he's kind of getting the inclination that now they're being passed on to his son, Andrew. So we'll talk about the validity. I want to talk about the validity of hypnosis kind of at the end, after we get the movie itself. But was it really this hypnosis session that kind of helped Whitley start to believe that these were real? Up to this point in the movie, he's still kind of resisting it and not wanting to believe that this is real. And then we touched a little bit on kind of this going on throughout his whole life. But at this point in the movie is when we kind of start to realize that. And was that kind of when he started to realize that as well?
For him, it was this, I've had these two really strange experiences. I need to learn more about it. And when he learned more about them, he ended up going back into these experiences in his past and just kept finding really odd features of all of these experiences. Like when he went into his December 26th regression session, at one point he actually jumped from December 1985 to, I believe it was sometime in 1958, where he was on a train with his father, and him, his father, and his sister all get abducted off this train. They all have this experience, and what really sticks out for him is seeing his dad, like, so afraid in front of these alien beings, and it just, like, really stuck with him at that point. And he keeps going back and finding these odd experiences. Like at one point he talks about how the aliens taught him to build like a particle accelerator, and he ends up building one in his bedroom, and it like kills the house's electricity. it was so weird. He talks about how there's a couple experiences camping in his backyard where he encountered, one was this like mantis type being, and it literally, when people talk about them in the abduction literature, they literally look like 7 to 8 foot tall praying mantis. And it ends up putting this like hat or something on Whitley to do something to his brain, and he doesn't remember much after that. He recounts this really odd 24-hour period where he keeps missing chunks of time. So he starts by he's heating up a TV dinner, and he's sitting down to eat it. And then all of a sudden, it goes from his lap to the coffee table, and he didn't put it down or anything, and 6 hours had passed.
Oh, wow.
And then he was going to go reheat it, and on the way to reheat it, another 12 hours had passed. And he keeps experiencing these jumps in time for about the course of 24 hours, which is, I don't even know where you begin with that.
That, I mean, if that happened, that'd be terrifying. You to not know, like, just kind of black out like that.
Yeah. And that's how he treated it. He thought he was just blacking out, like he had just problems, something wrong with his brain. So at a certain point, he eventually just runs out of the apartment, ends up at this all night diner, just mowing down on a big breakfast, and he just sucks down six glasses of orange juice. He keeps going through all these experiences. So for him, I think he's always going to struggle with kind of the reality of it. He may accept it, but he doesn't know what the reality of his experiences are. And that kind of makes for a tough movie to film, because if you don't have an ending, really, and you can't really say what the heck is going on, because... Yeah, like I've said, he had like five or six theories as to what these beings may be. It helped him deal with the reality of the situation, just not the reality of everything surrounding the situation and what causes it.
Yeah, in a movie, you want closure.
Yeah.
You want to know how the story ends. And if you don't know how the story ends, it makes for a tough movie.
It does, and it doesn't help when you have an actor like Christopher Walken, who is, how better to put it, crazy, or at least comes off as crazy in like almost every role that he's in. So to try and capture a guy like Whitley, who may be experiencing all these things, but is completely down to earth about it, it definitely makes for a jarring experience.
Well, speaking of jarring experiences, we can kind of wrap up the movie's timeline, because after the hypnosis, Whitley kind of starts to believe that these are real, at least in the movie. And so he decides to head back to the cabin by himself. When he gets there, there's this bright ball of light in the woods, and he grabs his video camera, heads toward the light. But he never actually videotapes it, of course. He heads inside to find the aliens there. And this is when it gets a little weird, as if it wasn't weird up until now. But little blue aliens take the video camera from him. And then he dances with them. And he realizes he's awake, so this must be real. And then you see Christopher Walken, another version of Whitley, as it looks to me, it looks kind of like a magician. He's got like a tux and a magic wand, a little pencil mustache. Mm-hmm. And then I don't really know how he comes to this, but he kind of comes to the realization that the aliens won't let the humans see them. They're purposely kind of hiding. And then all of a sudden he's back in his truck. It's daytime. Like it just cut there. And he goes home to Anne and Andrew and kind of seems to have this kind of a Hollywood happy ending where he's accepting the experience, at least, at least assuming that it's not necessarily something negative. They don't really know what it means, but it's something that he's come to the just to accept it. Now, I found it very convenient that Whitley never caught anything on video. That was something that, as I was watching the movie, I kind of noticed that, he's back in the 80s, you didn't have cell phones like today, so you didn't always have a camera with you, but it seemed like he always had a camera with him. And yet he still never really seemed to capture anything. So my final kind of question would be almost a two-parter. First, did he actually capture any video footage of these experiences? And then, of course, kind of that last strange experience with the dancing little blue doctors and such, was that something that we already kind of talked to him about, him whether or not he believed it was real or not, but was that something that he experienced as well?
At a certain point, he has a hypnosis session in March of 1986. And he goes pretty deep on it. And when he comes out of it, the image of the female, he has this image implanted in his head, but it's not just an image. He calls it kind of like a holographic projection. And
that's the same female you were referring to earlier?
Yes. Yeah. She's got the like really leathery looking skin like they do in the movie. And he's just had this relationship with her his entire life, which is something that is a common theme over and over again, is that abductees will report having a relationship with one of the beings, and they always have a gender, and it's usually a gender opposite their own. But he has this image in his head, and basically what he can do is he can ask it a question about like its anatomy or something like that, and it like shows him what it, you know, like what its feet look like, or what its hands look like, or what it looks like when it closes its eyes and such. So what ends up happening is that at one point he thinks in his mind, what would it be like if I asked the beings to come see me? And this image just gives him this hard glare. It wasn't anything malicious, but it was just a really hard glare. So the really intense dance sequence and all that stuff, that doesn't happen. And you get this theme over and over again that the beings themselves need to be in control. Like, Whitley gets the sense that they are kind of afraid of us just because we seem to be, you know, we're such free spirits, and they are kind of like a hive mind. They, like, many of them walk in a lockstep in unison, and they appear to, you know, follow orders, and they appear to just do what's required of them. So at the end, the last experience that he has in the book, it's one night. He's sitting up reading. He's fully conscious for this. And all of a sudden, appears three of the blue beings, like probably about 5 feet away from him on his side of the bed. And they're all like smiling. And then all of a sudden he sees one right next to him. It's one of the gray beings with the black eyes and the black mouth. But the weird thing about it is that it's wearing a cardboard cutout suit. It's made to look like a double-breasted suit, but it's made of cardboard. And he's wearing it, he's got a fedora on, and they're all just smiling at him. And this, to him, he takes it to mean that this is confirmation of his experiences, that he's fully conscious, they are real, and, you know, it's been happening. So that's how it ends for him. And and realistically, it's only about 170 pages in the book. The 130 that are left after that, he's just trying to make as much sense of it at all. But and then it just sends him down a path of where he wrote like 5 sequels to this. I mean, from 88 to 2012. So he's still out there writing them books. And he's like 73 years old now. Still doing it. And he hosts a podcast.
Yeah. Well, all right. So let's kind of start to make some sense of this ourselves. We've talked about the timeline of the movie itself. And so we can kind of move on to just kind of some of the overall stuff. One of the first things as I was watching this, I was thinking, have you seen The Revenant? So that was the first episode that I did on this podcast, actually. And one of the things, even as I was researching that, it's in that movie, you know, it's Hugh Glass, and he just survives just extraordinary things. But he does it alone. Like, he's the only witness there. And so you kind of have to take his word for it or just don't believe any of it. There's really no in between, because there's absolutely no way that we can verify anything that he did completely on his own. And so in my mind, even though there's others that are there. A lot of the things, at least in the movie, only happen to Whitley. And so it's almost a similar thing where you either have to believe him or you don't, and there's just not a lot of middle ground there. So I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are based on, we've talked a little bit about some of the other cases and things like that that you've studied. Do you think any of this really could be true, that he experienced this?
There are so many cases out there of people having these kind of interactions. In the book, he has a section called The Hidden Choir, where there are like support groups that meet to talk about their experiences and to deal with them. So Whitley kind of just touched it off, but people had been having these experiences for years. The first widely publicized abduction account came from Betty and Barney Hill in the 60s, who, when they were returning home from a trip to Niagara Falls, they encountered this UFO on the road, and it essentially took them aboard, subjected them to medical tests, and brought them back. And it kind of became a narrative, but it took almost 20 years for it to really hit the mainstream in such a way that, you know, people took it even remotely seriously, even though it's definitely one of the, you know, most hotly debated issues in UFO study. So, yeah, it's just the overwhelming amount of these type of cases, the fact that a lot of these people are suffering from things like PTSD. They have dissociative disorders because of it. And there was a really great Harvard psychologist, Dr. John Mack, who studied this. And even he couldn't find real-world answers for it. He believed it had something to do with consciousness, but he couldn't find real-world problems disguising themselves as aliens to describe it. So for me, I tend to err on the side of being open to it. I don't exactly know what it is, but it's definitely something that it just, so many people have experienced it, to not take it seriously and to not think that something's going on.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And I'm curious, based with Whitley being an author, I wonder how much that kind of played into his being a little more popular than others. But with it, what it sounds like, there's a lot of people who have these experiences. How many of them are kind of like Whitley's, where he went beyond just seeing them? I know there's a lot of people who, you know, see UFOs, but then there's the next step of actually, in Whitley's case, you know, being abducted by them. Is that something that's kind of unique from Whitley's story? Is that also something that a lot of people experience?
It's not entirely something common, because it shows up at a certain point in the literature and such. So it's tough to really say exactly if communion really touched it off, or if communion gave people an outlet to talk about their experiences and such, because we have abduction accounts from the middle to later 60s, even in the 70s. The abduction accounts from the 70s are really strange. I just on my podcast, I just covered the abduction of a young man named Lee Parrish. And he was just driving home from a friend's house at 1 a.m. And he gets abducted by this group of three, like, monoliths. They're not people. They're, like, one of them looks like a really tall wall. The other one is smaller, about 5 feet tall, and has the dimensions of a Coke machine. And the other one, the third one, is this... It almost looks like an enlarged antique adding machine. And they experiment on them and put them back. it's interesting to note how the abduction accounts from the 70s, the beings are all different. They're not this gray, typical being. That doesn't happen until after really Bud Hopkins gets involved in the phenomenon. They start to become like the figurehead for the abductions that are happening. And then you get to the 90s, and it kind of tails off because it just kind of loses steam. It loses popularity. It almost seems like it's a fad for popular culture, but people still report it. And the tough thing to grapple with is that you have people telling their stories now that are saying their stories, their experiences go back to the 50s and the 40s and even the 30s. So it's a really tough phenomenon to wrap your head around just because it almost seems to change over time, which is very, very strange. And it's something that keeps me up at night, man. It really does.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, I can't explain it. I mean, it's just something that, it's fascinating. All the range of different types of experiences, and something I'm curious about, this happened in the movie too with the hypnotic therapy. I'm curious, is that something that's, can you consider that trustworthy? I mean, if somebody's kind of remembering these things, and I'm assuming, I mean, if something happens to somebody and then they recount it later, of course, they're going to be going off of memory. And then you have in the case of Whitley, and I'm sure there are others, if the, you know, there's other experiences out there that kind of get pulled out through regression therapy, through the hypnosis there. And is that something that is common in order to remember things that you couldn't really remember? Or is that something that I've heard reports of, you know, how the therapist is almost implanting ideas, and they're kind of leading the questions a lot of times? Is that something that is an issue with that? Or is, like, I guess overall, how trustworthy can it be if somebody is remembering something through hypnotic therapy that they don't remember?
That's a hotly debated thing. In my short time at MUFON with Chris Cogswell, host of the Mad Scientist podcast, he had gone on this endeavor to kind of do new things at MUFON because they were a little stagnated. They've been doing the same things for decades, and it hadn't been giving any results to the public. So one of the things that he was working on is he was trying to look at the effectiveness of hypnosis on these type of patients. It depends on, at least from what I read, the person doing the hypnosis. If that the best people for it would be those that are not familiar with the topic, which Whitley Strieber, he initially consulted with Bud Hopkins. Bud Hopkins had his own person that he trusted to do hypnosis sessions, and he suggested to Whitley, hey, go see this guy, he's great, I use him all the time. And Whitley's like, nope, I'm gonna go find my own guy. So he finds this guy named Dr. Donald Klein, and through the course of, I believe he did 4 or 5 total hypnosis sessions, and they're transcribed. A good portion of them are transcribed verbatim. If you don't ask leading questions, you tend to see, you know, results that don't seem biased or don't seem like they are implanted. And even at certain points when he's asked leading questions, he won't give a leading answer. Because the idea is that, you know, if you ask a leading question, they're automatically going to, you know, say yes or go with that line. And when you read these transcripts, they don't always. And for instance, in the book with Anne, what you find is that Whitley has an easier time of going through hypnosis than Anne. Anne almost acts like she has this block. And the reason that she has this is because the way that she recalls her experiences, it's as if she serves an absolute function, which is to kind of ground Whitley, but also to turn a blind eye to it so that she's not exposed to it at all. And she talks about how there's, I believe it's the October 4th experience. She talks about how there's a friend in the room telling her that it's Whitley that has to go. It's Whitley that has to do this. She just has to lay there, and she's there for Whitley. So it's interesting to see how during that hypnosis session, because she actually used a different psychologist. She used a guy named Dr. Robert Naiman to do that. How even when he asked leading questions, he wouldn't get a leading answer. It wouldn't just follow that line. So I think the jury's still, you know, out 100% if it's effective for, you know, abduction abduction victims. But if you can find the trustworthy ones and using your best judgment, you can kind of discern which ones are good, which ones are bad, which ones are absolutely, you know, people asking leading questions. And at one point during Anne's hypnosis session, Bud Hopkins steps in and starts asking questions. And he confuses her because he's, at one point, he's trying to get her to remember something, and he kind of confuses her because he doesn't specify if he's talking about the October experience or the December experience. So there are definitely moments when some people just screw it up, like Bud Hopkins. I have my issues with him, but yeah, it's you got to take it pretty much by a case basis. Look at what they're asking. Take a look at the transcripts and see if it's good information, if it's bad information, if it's just people following where the hypnotist is leading them. Yeah, that's really the best way to look at it.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, the leading questions is something that it makes perfect sense, which makes me wonder then with Whitley, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but I used the term aliens, and you kind of reminded that he never used that term. He always calls them the visitors, which is, you know, with the overwhelming implication in the movie, at least, is these are aliens, but he still never calls them that. So that's almost a, you know, a leading question in and of itself. I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that comes at him where they're really trying to get him to just say they're aliens, and he's still not doing that. Do you think that helps add credibility to that, to his experience?
To me, it does. To a lot of people, it doesn't. And I know people who have read Communion, and they just roll their eyes at every single page. They don't even give it a chance. But the thing to understand is, like, Whitley did everything possible that he could not to contaminate his results. He went against Bud Hopkins' wishes, went with the psychologist that he felt would be good for him. He never actually told Anne anything about his experiences as they were happening. It was only after she had gone through her hypnosis sessions, which was months after he had started his. So they kind of were on separate ends of things. Which, you know, in the movie, she's in on it from the start. So that's one marked difference. And, like, oh, I forgot to mention this, but, like, in the book, the video camera stuff, he does not have a video camera. So that's kind of the reason why he doesn't capture anything on camera. He's just not that guy. He doesn't carry a video camera around with him everywhere he goes.
Well, I guess in order to get footage, you actually have to be able to have that camera first.
yeah, it's like, why did they... And here's the thing that I struggle with this movie. Whitley Strieber wrote the screenplay for it. And, like, I know people are going to edit it and such, but, like, this is your movie, man. Why did you write it like this? It's not even, it doesn't seem remotely close to most of what you experienced. But Whitley, every step of the way, he did everything I think a person should be doing if they want to explore their experiences, which is don't contaminate things. Just kind of keep to yourself as best as you can about it. Seek help. And, you know, explore, don't contaminate yourself with, like, he never really read UFO books during the whole time that he was going through these hypnosis sessions. But after that, you know, he included a bunch of research that he did into the book. But during all that, never once read a UFO book. Didn't try to taint his pool of information about UFOs, because he really didn't have an opinion one way or another. He kind of went with the government basically had three studies from of the UFO phenomenon from 1947 all the way up to 1969, and then when it was ruled in 69 that the government should stop looking into this, there's really nothing with it, he was just like, okay, fine, there's nothing to flying saucers, whatever, move on with your life. But in terms of just being as authentic as possible, I think Whitley Strieber is as authentic as he can be. And some people are going to get on board with that, and some people aren't. When I told people I was reading this book, and this is like the third time I've read this book now, which I don't recommend for anybody. Like, you got to be crazy to read this thing three times. But part of it is people saying, oh, this guy is like, he's totally bogus. He's totally just making it up, you know, just trying to sell books. I'm like, he's a writer. Of course he's trying to sell books. But it doesn't necessarily discount from his experience. It's like they forget that he was a really accomplished writer for almost 10 years before this came out. So Whitley is as genuine a person as I think anybody could be going through these experiences.
Now, you mentioned that, and I got to point this out, because my first thought watching, I think I've actually said that a few times, I have many first thoughts, but one of the things I thought of when I saw this was, and you mentioned Whitley was the wrote the movie as well. It seemed kind of convenient to me that he is an author. He writes science fiction. And then in the movie, there's a point where he's like, oh, he has writer's block. Like, I need to come up with an amazing story. And then he comes up with this amazing story that ends up turning into a New York Times bestseller, you know, and just, you know, almost, I don't want to say launched a career, because he already had a career, but there's a little bit of convenience there to play devil's advocate to my previous point of, you know, him not calling them aliens. But I wonder how much of that, aside from just the different nature of the experiences, makes it difficult for people to believe this. Do you think if he was not an author before, and I don't know if, you know, around the time that this happened, that he was experiencing kind of the writer's block, you kind of see happen in the movie. I don't know. I could see how that could also be seen as kind of a, oh, you were just looking for a good story and you came up with one that, you know, that you just, now you have to kind of ride the wave, so to speak. Do you think that kind of hurts his credibility in that way?
I'm sure to some people it will, but the writer's block is completely made up. He never had writer's block. He actually published a book, I believe, in 1985 and 1986 before he published Communion. So there is that bit that makes you wonder, maybe he's just good at telling a story. And I'll be honest, I've read Whitley's fiction, not his early fiction, but his later fiction, and I'm not a fan. I don't think he's a really totally great fiction writer these days, and I don't mean to jab at him, but it's just the thrillers that he's written the last since Communion, they definitely have that alien kind of spin on them. He's written a book about alien-human hybrids, a novel. He's written novel about this series called Alien Hunter, where this like covert group of government agents just hunts down aliens and stuff like that. He definitely has a mind towards horror and science fiction to an extent, but I don't think, at least for me, I don't think that colors anything in the book, because to me, even if abduction literature is not necessarily popular, but it's more mainstream than ever, and you're a successful writer and you write a book about your abduction experiences, there's a good chance that book is just going to flop. I don't understand why exactly Communia became such a successful bestseller. Maybe it's because of the way it was written. Maybe it was just how he came off in the book. I'm not exactly sure, but to me, it's more of a gamble to write a book like Communion. And at the same time, why would you write six sequels that don't have as wide an audience as Communion did? I know Communion sold like over like 2 million copies. So, and it's like one of his only books aside from his newer ones that are still in print from the past. But I don't know. To me, it's not as much of a deal breaker that just, you know, he's a good writer. Therefore, he's spinning a good tale here. Like I said before, he seems like a really genuine person through and through. He experienced some tough times after Communion, and like the years, the, you know, directly after, he filed for bankruptcy at one point, I believe in the '90s. And one of the saddest experiences for him, and I can't remember exactly where it was. I think it was in an interview I saw on YouTube. He was heartbroken that he had to sell the cabin in upstate New York. So, to me, it doesn't, but I could definitely see how that could paint people's pictures of Whitley and his writing.
Well, it sounds like in the end, people need to read the book on their own and make up their mind as to whether or not they believe him. And some people will, some people won't, just like any other story that's out there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, to kind of really hearken to the name of your podcast, the reason that people are so upset by this book, the ones that are, is because it has the words "a true story" written on the front. Mm. Imagine if it didn't even have those words on the front. Say this was a novel. It'd actually be a pretty decent novel if you kind of cut out all of the historical stuff. I mean, there's other interesting, you know, things beyond his experiences in here, but it would be a pretty interesting novel. But whether it's a true story or not, you know, that's ultimately, you know, every person has to decide that. So, if you're coming at it from the film, I'd say go pick up the book and get a better perspective on it.
Sounds great. Well, thank you so much, Rob, for your time and expertise, sharing it, for reading Communion yet again, a third time. If you read Communion, maybe you only read it once, not multiple times, like Rob sounds like. where can people find out more about your show and what you do?
Well, the podcast is available on every single platform. Just search for Our Strange Skies. I am on Twitter at Our Strange Skies. We have a Facebook page and a group. Just search Our Strange Skies over there. We're on Instagram, so I'm definitely out there. Thank you so much for having me on, man. This has been a blast.
Oh yeah, it's been a lot of fun. The whole subject of UFOs is something that fascinates me, and I really enjoy your podcast, so it was really exciting to have you on. Appreciate it.
Thanks, man. I definitely appreciate it too.
This episode of Based on a True Story was written and produced by me, Dan Lefebvre, along with some great assistance, of course, by my good friend Rob Christofferson from the Our Strange Skies podcast. If you want to learn more about Whitley Strieber's experiences, as Rob mentioned, one of the best ways to really decide for yourself how much you believe is to check out his book called Communion, A True Story. Some will believe, some will not. The choice is yours, but the first step is reading the book. And, of course, there's Rob's podcast, Our Strange Skies, that digs into tons of other fascinating stories like the one we've learned about today. I'll add links to Whitley's book and Rob's podcast and plenty more resources to help you get started over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. As a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one, Whitley Strieber never referred to the beings he saw as aliens. Number two, Whitley Strieber got video footage of the beings he saw. Number three, Whitley wasn't the only one to experience some strange things. Did you find out which one is a lie? As we learned, Whitley was not the only one to experience some strange things. Other people, like his wife, actually saw some of the lights and experienced strange things. They might not have seen the beings that Whitley saw to the extent that he did, but they certainly witnessed some strange things as well. So that would mean the lie is number two. As we learned, Whitley did not carry a video camera around with him like we saw in the movie, so no, he didn't get any footage of his experiences. So now it's your turn. What do you think about Whitley Strieber's experiences? We're at an end of our story today, but that doesn't mean it has to end your learning about the world of UFOs and strange experiences like Whitley's. If you want to learn more about that, I would really recommend checking out Rob's podcast. It's called Our Strange Skies, and you can find it anywhere podcasts are found. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.